This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 50 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be discussing philosophy of language and logical positivism. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Mike, I can't believe it's episode 50. When we first started doing Metatrex, frankly, when we first started podcasting, episode 50 is like a gleam in your eye. It is far in the future. And here we are doing episode 50 today. So I'm very excited to have reached this milestone together.
Milestones. We just recently celebrated 1 year of our podcast, and now to come up on episode 50, it's really exciting when I think about it. I think about the fact that a little over a year ago, you and I didn't even know each other, and you know, we were on a patrons roundtable together, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what kind of genre where I could make a entry into podcasting. Certainly my hope, my ambition was to podcast here on Trek FM, and you were hatching a brilliant idea for a podcast and approached me, and the rest is, as they say, is history. And you know, what a ride it's been. It's been great. I'm really looking forward to the future.
I would go so far as to say that we can empirically verify the meaningfulness of this 50th episode of Metatrex.
Well, Zachary, a few weeks ago, we had a plan for some podcasts leading up to episode 50, which we're here at right now. And this was our plan for episode 50, to talk about logical positivism. And I have to say that this isn't a subject that I'm as well versed on. And the reason being, when I first studied the topic, I basically determined that there were lots of holes in this idea. It was a good idea. It was plausible, but you know, dead wrong. And so I really didn't invest a lot of my studies into understanding it, probably as well as some of the other topics that we've talked about. But I do know some of the basic mechanics of it. I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
I think you're right, Mike, that logical positivism seems like a wildly implausible view until you start to situate it in the history of philosophy and come to understand why it arose in the time period that it did. So before we start talking about that, logical positivism is basically the view that the pieces of language that are genuinely meaningful are things that you can empirically verify. And so logical positivism, it's trying to distinguish between meaningful statements and non-meaningful statements. Productive philosophy versus unproductive philosophy, and as it applies to the sciences, genuine science grounded in things you can empirically verify, and pseudoscience that is not grounded in things you can empirically verify. And you have to remember that in the 19th century, the century leading up to the 20th century, there was a lot of speculative metaphysics going on. You had Kant. Talking about things in themselves a couple centuries before that. You had Hegel talking about universal spirit and the trajectory of world history and these things that you just couldn't verify. And so they thought that was an unscientific, unproductive direction of philosophy. And they wanted to bring philosophy back into the realm of empiricism, back into the realm of things you could study, that you could verify empirically using your senses. And when I say empirically verify, I don't mean things you can, in practice, empirically verify right here, right now. the idea is more that in principle, there's some way to go out and verify, the statements in question, some experiment you could do somewhere in the universe you could observe. So it doesn't have to be literally the things in front of you, you know, with your sight and your sound, you know, before your very eyes. But it, you know, in principle, that there should be some way to empirically verify things. That's the essence of logical positivism. So what logical positivism does is give you a test for the meaningfulness of language. Basically, anything that is not empirically verifiable, whether it's speculative metaphysics like Hegel talking about universal spirit in the 19th century, whether it's theology, theologians talking about God and the Trinity and properties of God, like God being omniscient and whatnot, the idea of Plato's universal forms, all this, anything that transcends stuff you can empirically verify, logical positivists would just write off as meaningless. And when they say meaningless, they mean literally meaningless. Meaningless like stuff that mirrors the structure of real language but doesn't have any meaningfulness to it. Kind of like Lewis Carroll's poem Jabberwocky. You know, you take a statement from that poem, it's sort of grammatically correct, but there's no content to it. Like, I'm thinking of the first couple of lines of one of the stanzas, "'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe," right? You know, that sounds like real language, but it doesn't mean anything. And so they would say that all of this, the speculative metaphysical talk that philosophers would come up with, is literally just meaningless mumbo jumbo. They can write it off as meaningless. They just want to set it aside entirely and focus on things that can be scientifically studied or empirically verified. And they just took a hard razor and said that other type of language, this non-empirically verifiable language, is literally meaningless mumbo jumbo.
And this is where Star Trek and philosophy, I think, really have a crossroads. Because oftentimes in Star Trek, we're presented with a problem that on the surface seems to be one thing. And by the end of the episode, we discover that it's another. And it's through this empirical analysis of the situation. I'm thinking, for instance, of episodes like Shore Leave from the original series. Cat's Paw comes to mind. It's a fog, but it doesn't have the properties of fog, right? And so what they're doing is they're analyzing, they're peeling apart these layers of this puzzle until they get to the truth. And so I think there's a crossroads right there. I think it's interesting too how oftentimes logical positivism and Star Trek go their separate ways. I'm thinking about things like the holodeck and the replicator. We just celebrated here in the United States the Thanksgiving holiday, and you know, I sit down like a lot of people, and we had a big turkey dinner. And you know, out there in outer space, they've got meatloaf, but they make it, you know, they form it like turkey. Or if you're in Picard, Janeway, DS9 time, you walk up to the replicator and you ask for turkey hot. And what you get looks, feels, tastes like turkey, but is it really turkey? So that's sometimes, I think, where we get into a lot of these metaphysical kind of, as logical positivists would say, mumbo jumbo. And all of a sudden, we've got an issue.
Well, I'm glad you're using the replicator as an example, because I think it's a good lead-in into an example that I was hoping we could talk about from the history of philosophy, and we can kind of give a Star Trek version of the example. But before we do that, I feel like there's just a little bit more background we need to give on logical positivism. So the logical positivists were people like Ludwig Wittgenstein in his early work, Rudolf Carnap, A.J. Ayer, and again, don't worry about the names so much. These are just philosophers from the early 20th century. And basically, what was going on at the time, in addition to the fact that they were trying to demarcate science from pseudoscience, there was a lot of progress in formal, structured, systematic logic that was happening in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And so, what these logical positivists, namely, I'm thinking of Ludwig Wittgenstein, were trying to do was use the relationship between formal logic and the structure of language and the fact that language corresponds to the world in some way, to learn things about the world by analyzing the structure of language and the structure of logic. And the idea you just mentioned, that language corresponds to something, when I walk up to a replicator in Star Trek and I say turkey hot or Earl Grey hot, the idea is that that corresponds to some object that I'm going to get in response, right? The language means give me the turkey or give me the hot cup of tea. And so this one-to-one correspondence between language and the world, you know, word and object or sentence and its reference, that is, the, I think, the crucial insight of logical positivism. And so the logical positivist really did have this direct correspondence in mind between language and the world. But the problem with that view, I think, is that it has a really overly simplistic view about what language is and the meaningfulness of language. And that philosopher I mentioned, Ludwig Wittgenstein, he himself rejected his own early work as he came to reflect on language further and further, culminating in what is commonly taken to be his greatest work, the Philosophical Investigations, his later work. And in that work, he basically gives an account of language, the meaningfulness of language in terms of the use of the language. You know, the language means not just a strict one-to-one reference to things in the world, but it means the meaningfulness of language is tied to how it's being used in various contexts. And mm-hmm. he gives really simple examples. Like, in fact, I could give you an example from Wittgenstein, but I think it's more fun if we do it Star Trek style. So I'm going to try.
Oh, we've got to do it Star Trek style.
I'm going to try to give a Wittgenstein-inspired Star Trek example. Suppose you know I'm standing there in engineering, and you're walking by the corridor, and you hear me shout, "Dilithium!" What are the possible things that that could mean?
That could mean you need dilithium.
That's, yeah, sure. I think that's one of the obvious readings, right? I need dilithium. What else?
That could mean that the dilithium is missing from the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
It could mean somebody took the dilithium. There are quite a few meanings just shouting dilithium.
Yeah, what else do you have? You can probably come up with a few more, right?
Oh, yeah, if I think about it for a second.
Maybe there's
were trying to solve a problem, and the answer to your question, or the answer to the problem, is dilithium.
Maybe I was telling Neelix, hey, Neelix, go find me some dilithium. Do your trading and give me some dilithium.
Sure.
Do you know your dilithium crystals are about to fracture?
Somebody dropped dilithium into the warp core.
Maybe it's just a curse word. Oh, dilithium, you know, in the 24th century. Double dilithium on you.
They use frack in Battlestar Galactica, so why not? Why couldn't be dilithium be the official Star Trek swear word?
Sure, Kirk would say double dilithium on you.
Double dilithium on you. Absolutely.
I guess my point is just that even a simple example like that shows that there's not a direct correspondence between the term dilithium and the object dilithium crystals, right? When someone says dilithium, they could mean a host of different things by that. Could mean I need dilithium. I've got too much dilithium here. I need to get rid of some. My dilithium is about to fracture. Neelix, go find me some dilithium. It could be a command. Dilithium, Neelix. Right? And so any one of these is a plausible interpretation of that phrase, dilithium, depending on the context and depending on my intentions and depending what I need and what my goals are. And that's a much more nuanced account of language than just the strict one-to-one correspondence notion of language. And so Wittgenstein basically thought that what philosophy had been wrong is take language out of its context. You know, what gives that term dilithium meaningfulness is the surrounding context and your intentions and what you hope to accomplish and your goals and all of the situational context that gives that meaning. If you take all that away and strip that out like philosophers are trying to do, remember, philosophers are always trying to strip away the non-essentials and get at the essential concepts and get at the essential meaning of things. And Wittgenstein is coming along and saying, wait a minute, all you're doing in trying to do that is stripping away the meaning, the context that gives language its meaningfulness. He actually calls it an abuse of language because language is essentially grounded in this situational reality of the situation that you're in.
So yeah, I'm imagining, Zachary, that I'm working on a problem. I'm trying to solve a problem for Captain Sisko, and I'm sitting at Quark's, and all of a sudden it comes to me, this problem I've been working on, and I yell out, dilithium. And then in my mind, I'm thinking that as Jake and Nog are passing by, they hear me shout dilithium. They give each other a fist bump, and the No J consortium is born again, and they go to the continuum, and they bring me some dilithium, when in fact I was simply working on a theory to make a presentation to Captain Sisko. It would seem rather odd that they would come and drop dilithium, assuming that what I was intending to say was that I needed some dilithium.
Well, I think if you have just sort of a strict propositional language, like if you were giving a sort of scientific account of the nature of dilithium, you know, if you said something almost tautological, like dilithium is crystalline in structure, if you said that, right, you can go, yes, okay, that's true or false. I can verify or falsify that statement, right? But, you know, if you take, you know, these other uses of the word dilithium, like we mentioned, if I give dilithium as a command, Neelix, get me dilithium, or if I say dilithium, or if I say double dilithium on you, you know, each one of these is a slightly different use of dilithium that aren't empirically verifiable. One is a command, and you can't verify a command, right? You know, if I say to the replicator, Earl Grey hot, that's not something you can empirically verify. That's a command. It's a request. It's not a statement. It's not true or false in that sense, like pure statements that are empirically verifiable are true or false. And what the logical positivists say is anything you can't verify is meaningless. And I think it's just wildly implausible. And I think Wittgenstein eventually comes to this conclusion too, that it's really wildly implausible to say this rich tapestry of language that we have that is grounded in our everyday context, that you know, with goals and purposes and situations and things you want to accomplish, to write all of that off as meaningless just because it's not something you can empirically verify. You know, when I say to the replicator dilithium or Earl Grey hot or turkey hot, I want something and I mean something by that. And it's not something you can empirically verify. It's not something that's true or false, but it's not meaningless mumbo jumbo. It's grounded in that situation. Likewise, when you're solving the dilithium problem sitting there in Quark's and you go dilithium because you solved the problem and dilithium is the answer to your problem, that's not true or false per se. You know, there's no statement being made there, but it sort of means something to you. It has some practical applicability. You've checked something off your list, you've solved a problem, you can fix the whatever, you know, needs fixing. And that's not meaningless. And I think it's just such an obvious point, but it's surprising how long it took people to really realize that logical positivism was off on an implausible trajectory. And the basic insight was just that it's self-contradictory, that logical positivism was making some universal claims about language. They would, you know, the verifiability criterion basically said all meaningful statements are things that are empirically verifiable. And then you go, well, what about that? Can you empirically verify that or not? And so it didn't, and the answer was no, of course you can't even empirically verify the claims that logical positivists themselves were making. So it quickly kind of became fashionable in the 20th century as a reaction against speculative metaphysics, but it died a very quick death too, because people started to realize language is richer than that. And the account of language that logical positivists were giving, their philosophy, their view didn't meet its own criteria for meaningfulness. It was a self-contradictory theory on top of everything. So, and I think you can find countless examples in Star Trek. I mean, anything that's not purely strictly empirically verifiable or strictly propositional. You know, it could be the symbolic language you get in the episode Darmok. It could be the meaningfulness of Data's poem Ode to Spot, right? These are things that are not empirically verifiable per se, but they're meaningful, meaningful to the characters and, of course, meaningful to us as viewers. So I think Star Trek itself is, you can find countless examples of meaningful language that doesn't live up to the criteria of that logical positivists were setting out in terms of empirical verifiability. And I love thinking of this, of Star Trek as a counterexample to you know, this what seems to you, I think you're right. It seems like a wildly implausible view on the surface, because now we're living in this post-20th century age where we have gone through logical positivism. We've seen the problems with it, and we live in this more postmodern time where we're open to subjective interpretations and whatnot. And we've kind of moved beyond the 20th century culturally. And I think to our 21st century ears, logical positivism sounds even crazier than it probably did to some people in the mid 20th century. But I think it's important to recognize that they were trying to do something good. They wanted to separate the fluff from the non-fluff, you know, the productive areas where we could make progress in philosophy from where philosophers have historically just spun their wheels and not really come up with any conclusions. And I think that is a remarkably admirable project. You know, I mean, what you don't want is a bunch of philosophers giving, you know, cockamamie theories that don't have any practical applicability or don't reach any conclusions, where you just end up with my opinion versus your opinion. That's largely unproductive rhetoric at that point. And they wanted to cut through all the chase and find some area in philosophy where we could make some progress and ground it in something we can verify and know for certain. And even if the logical positivist view itself kind of fails for all the reasons we mentioned, I think it's an admirable project, and it's still a problem. We still want to separate the productive good philosophy from the unproductive spinning the wheels philosophy. I think the project still exists.
Yeah, you said something really interesting there about, you said dilithium is crystalline in structure. And I thought that was really interesting because that brought me to really one of the biggest holes I think that we can poke in this idea. And that is this idea that logical positivism is dependent upon models. I think it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Thomas Kuhn who claimed that observations have to be model specific. And so when you say, for instance, dilithium is crystalline in structure, the model is crystalline, and that becomes disputable. So, you know, can you empirically verify that, you know, the properties of crystalline and what makes it up? So, and I think that claim by Thomas Kuhn, I think that's obviously, I think, can be disputed, but it's clear that you're dependent on a model. There's a paradigm there, you know, and so it just becomes this never-ending cycle of having to empirically verify what you just it becomes a cycle, and I think a never-ending cycle. And you know, those scientific models, they can't be verified, and they can be falsified, but they can't be verified. And so you have these problems. And then this idea that, you know, logical positivists reject metaphysics, for instance. I think even in and of itself, that rejection of metaphysics really is kind of a metaphysical statement all its own.
Well, you mentioned Thomas Kuhn in philosophy of science, and the rest of the philosophy of science in the late 20th century is, you can think of it as a reaction against this sort of naive empiricist view of the logical positivist. And I say naive because they had this very simplistic view of empirical verifiability that, you know, that you literally could take a statement in principle, even if it's not right, something you could observe right in front of you, in principle, you can go out there and use your five senses and set up an experiment and verify it, right? So, you know, just verify that the statement is true, and then you've learned something. Mm-hmm. And I think the reaction against that is one way of reacting against that is to argue empirical experience is not as simplistic or straightforward as that. So you mentioned Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn would basically say that whenever you're experiencing something and making a judgment, drawing a scientific conclusion, you're always weighing that in terms of the scientific paradigm that you're in that has its own background assumptions. You know, what, like for example, Newtonian physics had its set of assumptions about the nature of reality, you know, with particles and gravity, mm-hmm. and, you know, the sort of billiard ball approach to physics, right? And then you have, you know, the what he would call a paradigm revolution leading to special and general theories of relativity. And then you get another paradigm shift when you start talking about quantum mechanics. Very different background assumptions, very different views about the fundamental nature of reality, sets of background assumptions that you believe that you take for granted when you're doing experiments, when you're drawing conclusions, when you're problem solving about a particular topic. So his point is basically that there is no such thing as pure, raw, unfiltered experience that you can use to verify things. That you're always taking your experience and looking at it through different lenses, the lenses of your prior beliefs, the lenses of the scientific paradigm you're in, and whatnot. So there's no such thing as just this pure, raw, naive, simplistic experience. And the logical positivists, you could argue they had a very naive sense of what experience is. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, that's the important question is, do we have this direct experience of reality? Like when I say dilithium, do I literally mean that thing in front of me, that crystalline structure right there that I can see and I can touch and I can point to? And I don't mean anything more nuanced than that. I don't need to run it through a filter. I don't look at it through a paradigm. Do I have direct experience of dilithium, right? Or am I looking at it through the lens of everything I believe, through the scientific paradigm that gives sense to terms like crystalline structure and, mm-hmm. you know, powers warp ships and, you know, all, the various things that are loaded with the term dilithium? Which is it? Do you have that direct access to reality or not? And if you do have that direct access to reality, I think that makes logical positivism seem a little more plausible. If we do have direct experience with reality, unfiltered, unbiased, you know, just direct one-to-one access between my bits of language and the bits of reality out there external to me, if that correspondence holds up, then logical positivism seems a bit more plausible. If that doesn't hold up, if we're always looking at it through the filters of our prejudices and our biases and our scientific paradigms, my beliefs, the you know, my view about what's meaningful and what's not, if I'm loading my experience with all of that baggage, then logical positivism seems wildly more implausible. I think what I find so fascinating about the later Wittgenstein's sort of self-critique of his earlier view about this logical positivist view is the recognition that our linguistic lives are just more rich and more tapestried than this naive empiricism would lead you to believe. I think poetry is meaningful, and I think commands are meaningful, and I think political discourse is meaningful. And, you know, if you're religious, you're going to think theological language is meaningful. It's not something mm-hmm. that you can just write off as meaningless. Even if you can't verify it, it's not meaningless. It still means something. Like, you can look at the claims of the Bajorans. Like, you know, we want to keep grounding this in Star Trek talk. You know, look at the religious beliefs of the Bajorans. You can't verify a lot of the things they believe, but look at the meaningfulness of their culture and how important it is to them, the significance of it. I think it's overly harsh to write that off as totally meaningless, even just right. purely because you can't verify it. But that's exactly what the logical positivist said. They'd say, you know, take a Bajoran prophecy. If you can't verify that, you know, this language about the celestial temple and whatnot, they would just say, meaningless mumbo jumbo. Let's get down and do some real science and find some things we can actually verify. So I think in Deep Space Nine, what's interesting is the way in which there's kind of this shifting back and forth between pure religious prophecy, metaphysics, metaphysical beliefs that the Bajorans have, and things mm-hmm. that you can, in fact, empirically verify. Like, I'm thinking of when the wormhole gets discovered and the celestial temple gets revealed as the wormhole to the Gamma Quadrant, the wormhole is something empirical. You can look at it and you can study it, you can do science with it. And so that previously purely metaphysical language has now become put in the realm of things that can be studied. And you turns out you can, in fact, empirically verify and study some of the things that are referred to in this more symbolic metaphysical language. But I think the mere fact that we can have this discussion points to the fact that it's not as simple as saying, nope, I can't verify that, and it's meaningless. I think that language is just a richer tapestry, and the meaningfulness of the Bajorans' religious beliefs, the meaningfulness of the various types of language we have, all of that points to the mere fact that we can talk about it in a podcast like this shows that it's meaningful, that it's not merely mumbo jumbo. And it does language such a disservice to write it off as meaningless just because you can't empirically verify it. Although I really do think that it's important for philosophy to be self-critical and try to make progress and not just spin wheels, not just give one theory after another with no way of adjudicating between them. So I think where the logical positivists were trying to be successful was to give some criteria. What's meaningful, what's not? Where can philosophy be productive and where is it unproductive? And I think that's still an important project, even if their account of language is vastly simplistic. Whether it's in the philosophy of science with the more nuanced notion of empiricism, whether it's looking at poetry, whether it's looking at the Bajorans' religious prophecy, I think language, even a surface level look at language, will show that language is richer than the logical positivists gave it credit for.
Yeah. When I mentioned Thanksgiving being this week as we're recording this, I'm thinking about walking up to a replicator and ordering, for instance, a turkey leg. And I order that turkey leg and I sit down, and in my mind, I'm eating a turkey leg. You and I both know, because we have at least some rudimentary understanding of the science of a replicator, that it's not really a turkey leg. I mean, you know, a large fowl was not harmed in order for me to have this reorganization of protons and
that's a great example. I mean, you can take the phrase turkey leg. You know, strictly speaking, if the logical positivists were correct about about the correspondence between language and the world, yes, turkey leg would mean a literal turkey leg, you know, the turkey leg right in front of you. But even mm-hmm. even that's not simple. Do you mean one turkey leg? Do you mean all turkey legs for all time?
Sure.
Do you, and then if you broaden it a little bit and you start putting replicators in the picture, well, replicators don't produce real turkey legs. They're synthetic turkey legs. But that phrase still seems to refer to that. So even without talking about symbolic language and religious language and whatnot, you know, even if you still kind of have this roughly correspondence theory of language, that language corresponds to something in the world, you dive in just a little bit deeper. You go, wait a minute, turkey leg. Does that mean one turkey leg? Does that mean all turkey legs? Does that mean the replicated turkey leg? Does that mean, you know, and you're already spinning some wheels going, wait a minute, it's not as simple as, you know, one-to-one correspondence between word and object and word and object and word and object. Mm-hmm. You know, even the simplest, straightforward little dive into the meaningfulness of a term as seemingly straightforward as turkey leg, and you're already revealing the fact that the logical positivists have an overly simplistic view of how language latches on to things in the world.
Yeah, because most of the time when you walk up to a replicator and you order something, I mean, Captain Picard walks up to the replicator in his ready room, he orders tea Earl Grey hot. I mean, only a couple of instances that I can think of did he get something other than Earl Grey tea. At least he never complained about it. He sips the tea, seems to enjoy the tea. To him, it's tea Earl Grey hot. It's hot Earl Grey tea. And the only one that you would probably get any argument from is a Klingon, because, you know, for some reason, those replicators don't replicate moving gawk. It seems to lay flat there on the plate, so you get some argument. The same thing, I think, is true, Zachary, of the holodeck. When I walk into the holodeck and I bring up a program, for instance, in the TNG episode 11-001-001, the Bynars create a woman on the holodeck, Minuet, and Riker becomes emotionally attached to her. So much so that in the episode, I think it is Shades of Grey, when the alien has conjured up from his memory, from drawing from his memory, from his emotion, he cooks up this idea of Min, Riker's wife. And that was the fatal mistake, because as interestingly enough that Minuet was so real and his feelings were so real for her, that he had a special place in his heart and in his mind for her, he knew that she was not real. She's a fabrication. Am I going off in left field here when we're talking about logical positivism and, you know, what is, can we come up with empirical evidence that Minuet is real or not?
Well, I think there's a couple of directions you could go in responding to what you just said there. I think on the one hand, simulated reality, virtual reality for us, or holodecks in Star Trek, blur the line between what's real and what's not, right? When you, so you take a phrase like minuet, you know, even if assuming that's just a proper name, what does that refer to? Does that refer to a real person in some sort of real sense, you know, in quotes? I think if the answer is, if that's what minuet means, then it's, it doesn't refer to anything because minuet's not real, right? On the other hand, if minuet refers to the sensory perception of the simulated being, you know, photons and force fields, as the doctor would say, right? Then okay, sure, maybe that the term minuet just refers to whatever is actually in the holodeck, and it's not like that's not real. It just happens to be photons and force fields, right? So there is a referential component to it. But I think the heart of the criticism of logical positivism goes deeper than that. If you say, imagine Riker on his deathbed, reflecting on his life, and he screams out minuet. You know, what could that mean, right? I mean, you're kind of thrown into this uncertainty about what he was really meaning in saying her name, right? Could mean I love minuet. It could mean damn you, minuet, I never liked you to begin with. It could mean, you know, I wish minuet was still here. It could mean, you know, thanks for the good times, but I'm on to the next, you know. Right? Who knows? You know, you never know. It's Riker, right? You know, give me something to swig my leg over and I'm on to the next lady. So, I guess it's just not as simple, right? So yes, there is this referential component, just like with dilithium, there's a referential component. You know, with holograms, it's blurry. Like what does the term really refer to? But I think the heart of the later Wittgenstein's point is that that's not the only component of the meaningfulness of language. Yes, the term, you know, proper names tend to refer to things. Nouns refer to things, but just like you could scream dilithium and mean 100 different things, you could yell the name minuet and mean 100 different things by that. And that is the tapestry, the level of richness of the meaningfulness of language. So, you know, it is interesting to say, what exactly does this term mean and what does it refer to? But that, I think the mistake is restricting the meaningfulness of that term to purely those interpretations and not broadening the sphere to other possible interpretations and uses of language that are determined by context and by intention and just, you know, the rich, I keep using the word tapestry, but I think that's an accurate word, you know, this tapestry of language that we have that is nuanced and subtle and with overlapping contexts that mean different things. And that's the world of language that we live in. It's not this purely referential sense of language. Like when Riker says a minuet, he doesn't just mean, oh yeah, that thing minuet that I can point to, whatever that is on the holodeck, right?
A 17th century French dance. Maybe he wants to dance.
Riker wants to bust a move. Minuet. That's possible, right? You don't know because the word minuet doesn't just have to mean the thing on the holodeck. It can mean a bunch.
Zachary, only you would refer to a 17th century French dance with tiny little steps busting a move.
Well, in a 17th century kind of way. They still knew how to party in the 17th century, right?
They knew how to throw a shindig for sure. So you mentioned the Next Generation episode, Darmok. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that's an interesting, really, really an interesting example that you brought up.
I think it's an interesting question to ask what the logical positivist would say about the type of language that you see in the episode Darmok. If you take one of the phrases used in Darmok, something like Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Shaka,
when the walls fell. That's an even better one, I think. You know, if that language is historically based, if that language refers to something that actually did happen in that alien race's history, then the logical positivist, I think, would be okay with it. They would say, well, in principle, if you were there, you could observe these events and you could verify that they actually happened. And so that's meaningful. It's empirically verifiable according to the verifiability criterion for meaning that the logical positivist gave. I think things get a little muddier if you interpret that language as being mythological or mere stories. You know, to give an analogy, in fact, it's an analogy that comes up even inside the episode. You know, Counselor Troy, I think, raises the example, you know, imagine what you picture in your mind when you say Juliet on her balcony, right?
Right.
That's not...
And Dr. Crusher's response to that was, oh, an imagery of romance.
Right. And that's not historical. It's not something you can empirically verify. It's meaningful, but not because it's grounded in some sort of historical event. And I think that's where the logical positivist would start to go, wait a minute. If you say Juliet on her balcony, or if you say Shaka when the walls fell, then you're not really referring to anything that you can empirically verify. Yes, you might be able to verify parts of that. Like, okay, I understand the term Juliet and what that means. That's a proper name. I have some experience of people out there. I've got experience of balconies. And so that's meaningful to me. And I can verify that part. And we just combine these bits of language that do refer to things in this one-to-one correspondent sense. And we reconfigure them, shuffle them around, make a new grammatically correct sentence and spit out something like Juliet on her balcony. Right. Same thing with Shaka on the walls fell when the walls fell. If that is mythology or purely a story, it's an interesting question to ask. What would the logical positivist say about that? Would they say that's meaningful because we do have empirical experience of the components of that phrase, Shaka, whatever that means, walls falling. Okay, I have some empirical sense of what that means. And so it's meaningful because of this empirical component. Or is there a richer sense of meaning to it that's symbolic that is not subject to the empirical, it's not purely limited to the empirical component of that language?
I don't know. Would they reject it altogether because we're using metaphor? I mean, we're using these, religious or mythos type of statements that I almost think they would just reject out altogether as, you know, just some kind of pseudo language.
Well, I don't know if we ever really get the answer in the episode, right? We don't know for sure whether Shaka when the walls fell refers to an historical event. And I think if it's a genuine historical event, then I think the logical positivists would have no problem with it. They would just say, oh, you're talking history, and history is stuff that you could in principle verify if you were there. So it's meaningful. If it's more like mythology, if it's just a story, and I guess this is where there's a fine line of distinction between something that is a story and something that's a mythology or something that is a religion, right? If it's purely a story, then I think maybe the logical positivist might be okay with it purely because, because of the empirical component, because you understand the meaningfulness of the terms based on your experience and you've reconfigured them together into something that has some meaning, but that's different than mythology. If you have a mythology that you believe, like, you know, and it's an interesting question whether ancient cultures really did believe their own mythology or whether they were purely stories, right? If you look back at ancient Greeks and Romans, you can ask, did they really believe in those Greek and Roman gods up there? And, you know, did they believe in Zeus sitting on Mount Olympus? Or is that purely a metaphor? Is that purely a story? If it's something they believed, you know, to refer to something that's real in some metaphysical sense, that's not purely here, you know, in our physical worldly experience, then I think the logical positivist would say, nope, we reject that outright. That's not something you can verify. It transcends what's possible in the realm of experience, so it's meaningless. If it's just a story, then they might be open to the meaningfulness of that based on our past experience of the meaningfulness of the terms. So I guess it's a question of whether those stories, even if they're not literally true, are they just stories or are they intended to be metaphysical stories that refer to something that transcends reality? Like if you look at the Judeo-Christian culture, Christians believe in a God that is transcendent beyond reality, the creator of reality that has various properties, omniscience and omnibenevolence. And that's, for Christians, that's not just a story, right? They intend that to refer to something real, but something real in a metaphysical sense. That's not just real in the physical, here in the physical universe, right? It transcends the physical universe into the realm of metaphysics. And so that is the kind of thing that I think logical positivists would write off altogether as meaningless. They would just say, you can't verify that. It's literally metaphysical, transcends things that are verifiable in the physical realm. So it's meaningless. And so I guess the interesting question is the language that you get in Dharmak, is that just a story that is grounded in worldly experience? Or is that intended to refer to some sort of mythology that is metaphysical in nature, to that culture's gods and goddesses, you know, literally a mythology in the realm of religious experience? And I don't think we get the answer in the episode, right?
No, I don't think we do.
I always got the sense that the language in Dharmak was referring to historical events in that culture's history, but I don't know if that's just me reading into it or if there's anything in the episode that actually settles that issue. I don't think there is.
I always felt that it was some type of language from their own mythos, because Captain Picard's attempt to connect with the alien captain was to tell a story from our own culture, you know, the tale of Gilgamesh. And so he begins to lay that tale out, and there seems to be a connection there. The alien captain seems to be understanding where Picard's coming from. He's listening to the stories. They seem to be connecting. And what I felt was happening there was a sharing of cultural metaphor or mythos, and that was meaningful to them. I mean, Captain Picard could have said to him, Leffler and Crusher on the holodeck.
Right. So Mike, I'm trying to look at this through logical positivist eyes and see if we can make some distinctions here. So I want to kind of go through a few different types of these more mythological, more metaphorical statements and see what logical positivists would say. Juliet on her balcony. I think on the one hand, if Juliet doesn't refer to anyone and we're not talking about an actual balcony, then the logical positivist could plausibly say that's meaningless. On the other hand, I think, you know, I do have some experience with proper names based on people I've encountered, and I've had experience with, you know, some architectures. I know what a balcony is, and so I can piece that together into something that's meaningful, if not in some literal sense that refers to a real Juliet and a real particular balcony. Okay, so that's one phrase. Another one, you know, let's look at human mythology here. Say a statement from ancient Greece, something like, Zeus is angry on Mount Olympus. Right? Mm-hmm. What would logical positivists say about that? I think they're more likely to write that off as meaningless than Juliet on her balcony, because Zeus is intended to be a god on Mount Olympus that doesn't really exist. Mount Olympus doesn't really exist, even though I know what a mountain is and I have some idea of what a god or a goddess is. It's not grounded in any actual experience. I think maybe the only thing I can find there is the meaningfulness of the term mountain, right? I've seen mountains, so I know what that is. But Zeus, you know, is angry on Mount Olympus. That's not something you can verify. You can't say that's true or that's false. It's not truth functional in that sense. So I think would be more likely to reject that kind of language as meaningless. So now, Shaka, when the walls fell, what's going on there? Is it more like Juliet on her balcony, or is it more like Zeus on Mount Olympus?
And I think that's a great question, honestly. And it's not a question that they answer definitively in the episode. You have your impressions, I have mine, but you know, at the end of the day, I don't think there's any kind of real answer given to that question. It's left rather open.
But I think the thing that's interesting, though, is regardless of what the logical positivists would say, the fact that the alien captain and Captain Picard come to some sort of understanding based on this less literal, more story-based language points to the fact that that's meaningful, right? The fact that they can communicate because of it shows that it's meaningful. You know, they're able to get out of the situation at hand. They're able to part on amicable terms. Whatever, the skeptical worries of the logical positivists about the meaningfulness of that language seem to be easily defeated. The mere fact that the captains end up communicating at the end of it points to the fact that the language has meaning for them, that it's not just a question of meaningless mumbo jumbo. They've managed to use those grammatical structures, whatever they are, whether they're more like Juliet on her balcony or whether they're more like Zeus on Mount Olympus. Regardless, they've managed to communicate, and it meant something to them.
Mm. You know, and this may be off in left field. I'm thinking about the episode of Enterprise Strange New World where a toxin was stirred up on the planet's atmosphere. And what happened, it caused the crew to have various type of delusion. Everybody saw rock creatures and T'Pol began speaking Vulcan, and so there's that interesting scene there in the cave where T'Pol is speaking Vulcan. Trip is seeing these rock creatures. He's convinced that there's some kind of conspiracy, and they get, you know, Captain Archer on the comm, and he's trying to talk Trip down, and he's unable to do it, and they conjure up this story finally that, you know, to Paul's talking to the rock creatures. And I think about the point that I wanted to make about that was that, you know, they were able to take his lack of understanding of the Vulcan language, and they were actually able to manipulate him using the delusion that he was having. So they kind of played into that narrative. And so I think about even language itself, and yeah, we can, you know, we can study language, we can learn language, but even language itself, I think becomes a barrier when we're talking about logical positivism.
Again, I think the logical positivists just had this view of language that you can understand why they started thinking this might be a fruitful project. They would take a statement like, I mean, dilithium is crystalline structure, right? And you can start to decompose that. What do you mean by dilithium? Okay, well, you know, dilithium means what, two lithium atoms or something, right? Okay, you can start to decompose that crystalline structure. Boom, boom, boom. What does that mean? You can spell it out in terms of progressively smaller and smaller units of language and units of experience to the point where you can go, okay, atom, that corresponds to this particular kind of thing. And crystal, that corresponds to this particular kind of thing. And at a very sort of fundamental, you know, I'm thinking like the lowest level of physics, atoms and subatomic particles and molecules, right? If you start to get this view that language corresponds at that level, when I say dilithium, I mean this kind of molecule, or when I say crystal, I mean this kind of structure, this kind of molecule, right? And then you start to build up your picture of language based on the relationship between these small components that correspond to things in the world. That sounds good in principle. And I think, you know, for lots of types of language, that makes sense, right? I can say, you know, I'm looking around my desk, I can say, you know, the cell phone on my desk, right? Well, what does a cell phone mean? You can kind of decompose that idea into smaller and smaller and smaller parts. Well, it's got this metal casing, and it's got an antenna, and it's got this radio built in. Well, what's a radio? Well, it's got coils, and it's got resistors, and it's got all this stuff. You can just keep decomposing it, right? And you put all that together and you get these higher level concepts like cell phones and dilithium crystals in Star Trek. Well, I think where it starts to fall apart is when you have language that doesn't seemingly correspond to direct experience. What about, I mean, you mentioned rock creatures, right? What happens when you go, well, I seem to have experienced a rock creature, right? Yes. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
did I experience that or not? Is that grounded in my experience? I think there's two ways you could go here. One way is to say, well, you do have experience of rocks and you do have experience of creatures and boom, boom, boom. And if you decompose those, you can go, yeah, you can put all that together and synthesize this concept of a rock creature, even though you don't have direct experience. And if you do have direct experience of one, it's probably a hallucination or a dream or a phantasm of some sort, right? But it's not meaningless because you have fundamental experience of the fundamental components that make up that complex idea. That's one way of it, a charitable way of interpreting the vision of a rock creature. I think if you were a logical positivist and you didn't want to say that's meaningless, I think if you're a little bit less charitable, you would say, rock creature? No, you've not experienced a rock creature. You've had a hallucination. So that's more like meaningless mumbo jumbo. That's not grounded in any genuine sense of empiricism. It's more like a hallucination. And again, it's an interesting, I think even the logical positivists could go either direction. I think they'd probably err more on the side of rejecting hallucinations as meaningless, even though they're grounded in some sort of experience. I think, you know, charitably, a logical positivist could say, well, yeah, there's these mythical things you imagine, like a unicorn, right? Okay, I have an experience of a horse. I have experience of horned beings. You put the two together and you get a unicorn. Okay, great. That's not meaningless. It's just that I'm rearranging my experience in different linguistic ways. And that's not meaningless because I do have, you know, all of those components are grounded in reality in some way for me. On the other hand, you can go, I've never seen a unicorn, or I've never seen a, you know, if you're Klingon, I've never seen Feklar, right? So that's meaningless in that sense. And I think the logical positivists, you could give them a charitable reading that would allow for the meaningfulness of those kinds of mythological terms.
Yeah, and honestly, Zachary, and kind of pull ourselves out of Universal a little bit, and let's assume that we have someone listening to our podcast today who perhaps is not a Star Trek fan. Let's say their interest in the podcast was solely because of something in the description that piqued their interest philosophically. And so they're tuning into our podcast and they're listening and they keep hearing you mention dilithium and dilithium crystals in particular. I mean, dilithium, you know, we know what dilithium is in the world. It's two lithium atoms, but you know, we understand it mostly in our world as a gas. The idea of dilithium crystals is largely an invented thing in Star Trek. And so the idea of dilithium crystals is meaningless to somebody who's not a Star Trek fan. If you're not a Trekker or a Trekkie, you don't know what dilithium is. You have no idea that this, you know, kind of purplish sort of crystal is used to enhance the matter-antimatter mix and run this faster-than-light warp engine. And so even that idea of dilithium is absolutely meaningless unless you are a Trekkie or a Trekker.
First of all, I love the idea that there are these underground logical positivists out there who are desperate for podcasts to listen to. And so if you out there are a closet logical positivist and you found us for the first time, welcome. but I think you're right. The logical positivists, you have to remember what their goal is. Their goal is to separate productive, meaningful philosophy from unproductive, meaningless philosophy. So when they hear something like dilithium crystals, you know, I think, again, on a charitable reading, they can go, oh, okay, dilithium, two lithium atoms and crystals, I know what that is. So in some broad sense, that's meaningful. But the more, I think what logical positivists would actually say about that is, that's unproductive. This is pure fiction. This is not revealing anything about the nature of reality that I'm learning anything real from. So it's more like Jabberwocky and less like something meaningful. So as I was thinking about logical positivism as it relates to Star Trek, I was trying to think of other examples where language is really at issue inside Star Trek itself. And one of the examples that came to my mind was the example from the Next Generation episode, Ensigns of Command. And in that episode, there's a fascinating discussion between Counselor Troi and Captain Picard about the meaningfulness of language. And she basically says something like this. Suppose we're stranded on a planet, we have no language in common, but I want to teach you my language. And then she holds up her glass of tea, and she says, Samarith. And she asks Picard, okay, what did I just say? And he says, he thinks about it for a second, and he says, cup. Okay, glass. And she says, are you sure? Maybe I meant liquid. How about clear, brown, hot? And that's just a couple of examples. And I think the point is just that could mean countless different things. In fact, it could mean, you know, I'm really thirsty. Get me some more tea. It could mean I really don't like you and I want to throw a cup of hot tea in your face, right? It could mean a thousand different things. And I think where it sounds like that could be an example similar to Wittgenstein's point that, you know, you take a given phrase and it could mean a bunch of different things. You don't really know which. I think the reason that example doesn't kind of fails in my mind as a counterexample to logical positivism is that really Counselor Troi is still thinking largely referentially. There's a particular word in that language and it refers to something. And then it's like a guessing game. What does it really refer to? And it's like, if you happen to hit on the right thing, if it really does mean brown, then ding, 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 you won. You guessed it and you understand what that word means. If it really means liquid, then ding, 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 you know what it means, and it means liquid. But I think Wittgenstein's point is a little deeper than that, that word, whatever it means, can be used in a bunch of different ways depending on context, and it doesn't make sense to say that there's one and only one meaning of a particular word or a particular phrase, and it depends on the context. So I guess, Mike, the fundamental question for me is language fundamentally referential or not? Is the primary or the primary meaning of language the referential component? When I say dilithium, does that refer to dilithium crystals? When I say, you know, Earl Grey hot, does that mean a literal cup of tea? Is that the primary meaningfulness of language? Or and all the other meanings, either they're meaningless or they're secondary meanings? Or is language so rich that you can't ever sort of get firm or settled on the precise meaning of a particular term for all time for everyone to agree on? And if that's the case, first of all, how do we ever communicate? First, it's an interesting question, how we ever communicate with anyone if language is so fluid that we never you never can know for sure what a term means. But I think the answer to that point is just that we share context, right? If we're all in the shared, you know, are the same shared context, if things that matter to you also matter to me, then we have some grounding on which we can, you know, communicate, even though we may not be able to precisely determine the one and only meaning of the various terms and phrases that we're using. But, you know, the logical positivists would just say that the primary meaning of language, the only meaning for them, but the primary meaning would be the referential component. And Wittgenstein, the later Wittgenstein, would say, well, no, that's just one among many different types of meaning. And yes, that's important. You know, and if you're going to do science, then you need to worry about the reference of your terms. But if you're doing poetry, then you don't care so much about whether your terms refer to anything in reality.
I really like that example that you used of Deanna Troi, and it really, for me at least, Zachary, highlights this idea that I had that we can poke some holes in this because language largely is relative. And I think of other examples that really don't have so much to do with logical positivism, but, you know, the idea of how nuanced language can become and how easy it is to misunderstand or to, you know, to misinterpret something that somebody is saying. I think in Enterprise, when, you know, the crew had offended an alien species because they were using their hands to put food in their mouth, and that became offensive. And so they're demanding an apology. But, I mean, they don't even know how to provide a proper apology. Later on, Porthos goes down and, you know, pees on a tree. I mean, that's what dogs do. And so, you know, they're demanding an apology. But the apology for that, Zachary, was not, you know, geez, I'm terribly sorry that my little beagle here peed on your tree. But rather, it was more based in ceremony. And so the ceremony had meaning.
It's so interesting you make that point, because the later Wittgenstein has this concept that he calls a language game. And by language game, he means the particular sort of web of activities and practices and unwritten rules. And yes, language is part of that. But, you know, whether they're actions or bits of language or practices that make up a certain context. And he thinks of about these things as being in a really granular level. I mean, think about life aboard a starship. Think of how many different things you would have to do in the course of life on a starship. Giving an order, receiving an order, hailing an alien culture, first contact situation. You come up with 20 other examples of things you might.
Well, and that first contact situation has regulations attached to it and procedures that have to be observed.
Right. And I guess Wittgenstein's point is the meaningfulness of those actions and the language are tied to that activity. It's not, you can't separate it from the context of that situation, a first contact situation, a first contact scenario, a scenario where the captain is giving an order, a scenario where you're changing command, a scenario where you are doing scientific research, right? Each one of these is its own little language game, and there are unwritten rules. And when you violate one of the rules, you know it. When if you stroll in and sit down in the captain's chair, you violated a rule. The captain's going to look at you and say, get out of my chair, right? That's violating the rules of the language game. And, you know.
Or Scotty's going to say, he really likes that chair.
But I guess my point is just that, you know, for any one of these kind of linguistic practice-based activities, there are unwritten rules. There's a right way of playing the game and a wrong way of playing the game, mm-hmm. right? Even doing a podcast, there's a right way of doing the podcast game and the wrong way of doing the podcast game, right? And, you know, there's a way, I mean, think about it, the way we do our show. There's a certain kind of intro. We do a certain set of things in the outro. We have a certain give and take during the discussion. And if you start to deviate too much from a certain way of doing things, you're kind of breaking the rules of the game. And I think Wittgenstein thinks of language as like that. The language is not just a question of the meaningfulness of the words, but language is tied up with the various practices that you're doing to accomplish something. So, you know, if you're an ensign getting an order from your superior officer, there's a kind of protocol. You go, yes, sir, or aye, sir, and you do it, and there's a kind of respect, and there's just a demeanor, and all of that is part of the language game. It's not just a question of the meaningfulness of the words involved. And you can take any one of those phrases, or if any phrase in general. If we're asking about the meaningfulness of language, what Wittgenstein would say is, well, if you want to know what the meaningfulness of dilithium is, you don't ask about what it refers to. You say, what language game are we playing? What do you want to accomplish? What situation are you in? What's the goal? What are the relationships involved? And that is, it will reveal much more about the meaningfulness of how that language is being used in a certain context than just this referential component to language. So it's fun to think about, because you sort of realize, you know, if you think about all the things you do throughout your day, from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night, all the different practices that you do and habits that you have, how much of that is tied up with these unwritten rules? You know, there's a certain, you know, if you wake up in the morning, you're making your breakfast, and if you go out the door and you go to Starbucks and you order your coffee, and if you're in Star Trek, you go to space Starbucks and order your coffee, or you go to Quark's and order your Ractuccino. There's a certain way of doing that. And then you report for duty, and there's a certain way of doing that. And you do your job, and there's a certain way of doing that. And all of this is tied up with the meaningfulness of what we're doing. And it's all bound by these unwritten rules that everyone seems to be aware of within the context, but no one really draws attention to explicitly very often.
You know, Zachary, I'm reminded of Seven of Nine's observation in Voyager. You know, she makes the observation in Someone to Watch Over Me that there are so many ritualistic kind of social actions tied up in the interactions of people that it's, you know, it's very complicated. And so, you know, she has the doctor to, you know, put together a study, if you will. He puts a program together, and they go through these exercises, and they role play, and this is how she's going to learn certain social graces.
Which itself is kind of a language game for them.
Exactly. It most certainly is. But fascinatingly enough, Her observation is exactly right. There's so much more to understanding human language in this case than just observing dialect or, the vocabulary. It's tied up in body language and all kinds of little nuances.
Yeah, I mean, think of, in fact, I'm actually thinking of an episode of Enterprise when I don't remember the episode. It's early in Enterprise when T'Pol is invited to dinner in Captain Archer's quarters. He and Trip are there, and they order steak, and they make a joke about her being a vegetarian. And so in that episode, T'Pol is learning to play the language game of how you eat with humans at the dinner table. You know, how you use your utensils, the kinds of things you say, the kinds of things you don't say. They expect a clever story and some banter because that's what they do at the dinner table. And T'Pol is going against the grain in a lot of ways, but she's kind of learning to interact like humans do. But think how much of that is nonverbal, and yet it's still meaningful, right? There's all the words they're saying, of course, but then there's what you do with your utensils and where you put your silverware and how you fold your napkin, and then what kind of conversation is appropriate and what kind of conversation is not appropriate. You know, how do you not offend the Vulcan who's joining you for dinner, you know, and so on. And all of this constitutes the tapestry of that language game, you know, dinner with the captain language game. And T'Pol is learning to play that game, and they're toying with her a little bit, but it's
and she schools them as memory recalls, and shows them that yes, you can eat that breadstick with a knife and fork.
Totally. But if you ask about the meaningfulness of what of that interaction is not tied up with the correspondence of their language to reality, right? The meaningfulness is this rich interweaving of the meaningfulness of the words in context, all the various practices, and this web of things you do and don't do that is largely unwritten. It's all subtext. None of it is discussed in the episode. It all plays nonverbally. And Wittgenstein's point is language is more like that. That language is tied up with this web of things we do and don't do in various contexts for various purposes. Like dinner with the captain is different from, well, okay, like I keep going back to Voyager. Like say for one reason or another, Harry Kim gets invited to dinner with the captain, right? That never happens, but suppose that happened, right? The way Harry Kim would interact in that context, in that situation, the kinds of things that would be discussed, the meaningfulness of the language and practices would be different than if Harry was going to Sandrine's with Tom, right? That's a different linguistic context. Even if they use some of the same phrases and the same words, they would have very different meanings and can and be and relate to other things in that in that in those contexts very differently. So I think, you know, Wittgenstein's point is you can't just focus on the meaningfulness of language absent its context. You have to go, well, what situation are we in and what else is interwoven with that language? And then we can talk about meaningfulness. But it doesn't make sense to talk about the meaningfulness of language unless you know what context we're in. Well, Mike, we've been talking about logical positivism now for about an hour, so I think we should try to wrap up with some final thoughts. For me, I think this notion of a language game as a reaction against logical positivism. It's one of these concepts in the history of philosophy that you kind of have to deal with no matter what. And, you know, I'm coming at this from a philosopher's standpoint where in the history of philosophy, there are just some moments where no matter what was going on in the history of philosophy, no matter what your worldview is, no matter what your quote unquote philosophy you have to kind of answer to this new concept. I think Kant's philosophy is like that, where no matter what view you have of reality, you have to wrestle with the fact that maybe you're active in constructing your own reality. So Kant is one of these major figures in philosophy for me. And I think Wittgenstein is like that, because whenever you come along in philosophy and you say, well, I've got a philosophy about blah, 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 and I've reasoned my way to it, and I think I've got some sort of essential truth about something, Wittgenstein can come along and say, well, are you talking about essential truth? Are you so bound up inside your language game that you're talking about something purely in a certain context and not talking about its essence for everyone for all time? So it really does kind of undermine our ability to give universal truths in philosophy that are context independent. So in my mind, it's even though Wittgenstein is responding to the later Wittgenstein is responding to this logical positivist view about the meaningfulness of language, really you can view his own reactions as a type of skepticism about our ability to get to access universal truths at all. That all of our language and all of our philosophical concepts are tied to a particular context, a certain, you know, when you're asking about the essence of something in philosophy, Wittgenstein can come along and say, well, why do you want to know? What context are you asking from? Are you playing the philosophy teacher game? Are you playing the philosophy podcaster game? You know, which context are you in and what game are we playing? And that's the only standpoint from which you can have a meaningful language. So, and I think no matter what your view of philosophy is, you have to have some sort of answer to the question of language and its meaningfulness. So I'm glad we got to spend some time today talking about the meaningfulness of language in general, because I think people generally sometimes have this naive sense of language that cup means cup and glass means glass and dilithium means dilithium, and that's what meaningfulness is. And Wittgenstein comes along and says, no, the meaningfulness of language is way more subtle than that. It's more like Darmok and more like Data's ode to Spot and less like cup and glass and dilithium.
Well, the only thing I really have to say, you know, apart from that is again something I've already touched on, and that is, you know, this idea of logical positivism as a whole and we've said this in the Turbolift a few times, Zachary, you can just poke so many holes in it. I mean, this idea that you just, you know, completely reject metaphysics. You know, first of all, this idea, this claim that metaphysics isn't needed. I mean, that is, in my mind, in itself, a metaphysical claim. So, you know, it's just really easy to poke holes in this. You know, you don't need ethics, you don't need religion. You know, these are all, you know, kind of mumbo jumbo, meaningless things. It's meaningless language. So, you know, for me, that's just, you know, that's just one big hole that we can poke in it. And also, Zachary, you know, this idea that in order to really empirically verify something, you have to have a model. And so, again, using the idea of dilithium crystal being crystalline, you know, you have to have a model. So what is crystalline? And then you have to empirically verify that. And so it becomes this never-ending cycle of, you know, can we empirically verify? And it, you know, there are just some things, especially in the Star Trek universe, that you can't empirically verify. And there are open questions, you know, and certainly Star Trek gives us, you know, incredible examples of things. But I think, you know, of the crossroads that Star Trek has to this idea of logical positivism, and that is the wonderful way that they examine and re-examine the evidence they have to get to the truth. I use the example of cat's paw. You know, they had a fog, but it didn't have the properties of fog, so they dig a little deeper. And I think about, Data sitting there at a console. He's digging a little deeper. And Star Trek has a wonderful way of doing this, and it really is inspiring to me and challenging to me that I guess my positive takeaway from logical positivism is that it's important to keep on digging until, you know, we come to some concrete conclusion that is empirically verifiable.
And I think Star Trek as a whole has a broadly scientific worldview, and in parentheses, a broadly logical positivist worldview that a great many characters in Star Trek, when faced with some unknown phenomenon, some new feature of their experience that they can't explain, will try to spell it out in scientific terms. Jadzia Dax is like this. She doesn't think of the wormhole aliens as prophets. She thinks of them as wormhole aliens. And she's going to give this naturalistic, scientific, empirical reading of things. So, you know, she wants something she can study. And if she can't understand prophets, but she can understand wormhole aliens, right? And even if they refer to the same thing, you know, one has this metaphysical connotation that she's not interested in, and one has this scientific connotation that she is interested in, she thinks is productive. And I think you said something interesting. You mentioned that you think that the idea of rejecting metaphysics is itself metaphysical. I'm not sure I understand that so much, but I think another important aspect of logical positivism is that they don't just reject metaphysics, but they also reject ethics. Anything that is in terms of right or wrong, or we do need this or we don't need that, these are things that logical positivists also reject because they're not empirically verifiable. You can take a value claim like, patience is a virtue, right? They go, okay, you can't empirically verify that, so it's meaningless. You know, let's take an ethical claim like it's right or wrong to commit murder, or it's right or wrong to violate the prime directive. They would reject that as well because you can't empirically verify that something is in fact morally right or morally wrong. So they don't just write off metaphysics, but they also write off anything normative in terms of the way things should be or shouldn't be or ought to be or ought not to be. And the idea that, we can reject metaphysics because philosophy doesn't need it, that doesn't sound metaphysical to me so much as it sounds normative. It's more like in the realm of an ethical value claim about what philosophy needs or doesn't need. And again, insofar as it's normative and not purely descriptive, they would probably reject that as meaningless as well. So I don't know if it's strictly metaphysical, but it's mm-hmm. definitely in the realm of normative ethics in terms of what is good and healthy and productive for philosophy versus not good and healthy and unproductive for philosophy. It's more similar to like what you get in ethical value judgments than strictly something strictly metaphysical. So I guess, Mike, for my final thought, it's just that it's a very difficult line to walk because I think there's a good side to logical positivism, this attempt to try to ground philosophy in something productive. So it's not just pure speculation, pure spinning of wheels, people throwing out theories that don't really have any criteria for acceptance or rejection. So I think that's the good side. And groundings, like in Star Trek land, grounding your theories in something scientific is a good thing, right? You do want to be able to, you know, study and get real knowledge. And you do need to be able to separate something genuinely productive from something that's not productive. And language is only one way to do that, I think. But the hard thing, I think, is drawing that line, saying this is something we can verify. This is something that's productive philosophy. It's not pure speculation. It's not pure mythology. It's not pure religion. It's not pure ethics. But doing so in a way that you don't naively reject the meaningfulness of other kinds of language. And I think our quick little survey into different kinds of language in Star Trek, whether it's Darmok or whether it's Data's poetry, these are different kinds of language than purely sort of scientific, empirically verifiable language. And the logical positivists, I think, err a little bit too much on the side of rejecting the meaningfulness of those kinds of language, despite their virtuous attempt to try to settle on something that is productive, some criteria that you can use to distinguish productive philosophy from unproductive philosophy, or something genuinely scientific from genuinely not scientific. So I think the logical positivists kind of just throw out the baby with the bathwater, to use a cliche metaphor. They are too quick to reject other types of language that don't really affect you know, what they're trying to say philosophically. What they're most interested in is science. You know, what can we do scientifically that's productive, and how can we keep all this other linguistic stuff that's going on from interfering with this productive science? And I think that itself is a good thing. You do want to separate speculation from genuine science, but you don't want to write off the rich meaningfulness of the rest of our linguistic and cultural practices in the attempt to do that. And I think they just err too far on one side. So that's kind of my final thoughts on logical positivism. Well, I hope you listeners out there have had fun joining us on this 50th episode of MetaTreks, talking about logical positivism and the philosophy of language in Star Trek. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Don't watch any of the extras on the first disc because they're all duplicated over the second disc. So then that way you can just watch them in order and not have to worry about, oh, well, let me skip this one because I watched it on the first disc and do all that.
Wait, to clarify, they have all the special features in column A on one disc and then all the special features of column A plus column B on a second disc?
That is correct.
That makes no sense to me at all.
I know, I was very confused when I sat down to watch it.
Melodic Treks.
Matter? I barely know her. Oh, it's painful. I don't know. You snowing me? You snowing me?
Painful is just saying Remus and blah, blah. I felt myself falling asleep. I felt like it was my parents were telling me a good night story where you were giving me that track listings there that... like.
Does it still McFly?
That's one of my favorite ones.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Within about 15 seconds, you texted me back, Dr. Giggles, we have to do Dr. Giggles. And my question for you is,
yes,
why did we absolutely have to do Dr. Giggles?
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions, and that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
Or you can leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
On Facebook, it's facebook.com/trekfm, and while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. That is our listeners-only discussion group. It is a closed group, but if you ask to join, one of our admins will let you right in.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not hanging out with Lewis Carroll and gyring and gimbling in the wabe, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, I'm most active on Facebook, certainly around the Babel Conference. You'll be able to catch me there. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you are not getting down minuet style on the holodeck, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on the network?
Well, likewise, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there on Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for Metatrex, Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter under the handle at MagicDrop5, and Kay Shaw. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. We really want to thank you both for your support of Metatrex in particular and the Trek FM network in general. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
I'm digging Jabberwocky, man.
Are you saying it was Brillig?
It was Brillig.